This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I've been a fan of Clint Eastwood ever since he started herding cattle on the TV western Rawhide, when he teamed up with Italian director Sergio Leone for the spaghetti westerns A Fistful of Dollars and The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Eastwood began his transformation from actor to icon.
Listen, stranger, didn't you get the idea? We don't like to see bad boys like you in town. Go get your mule. You let him get away from you?
See, that's what I want to talk to you about. He's feeling real bad.
Huh?
My mule. You see, he got all riled up when you men fired those shots at his feet. You see, I understand you men were just playing around, but the mule, he just doesn't get it. Of course, if you were to all apologize...
I don't think it's nice, you laughing. You see, my mule don't like people laughing. It's the crazy idea you're laughing at him. Now, if you apologize, like I know you're going to, I might convince him that you really didn't mean it.
After Eastwood reworked the Western genre, he revitalized cop movies with his Dirty Harry series.
I know what you're thinking, punk. You're thinking, did he fire six shots or only five? Now, to tell you the truth, I forgot myself in all this excitement. But being this is a .44 Magnum, the most powerful handgun in the world, and will blow your head clean off, you've got to ask yourself a question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, punk?
After years as an action hero, blowing people away on screen, Clint Eastwood directed and starred in the movie Unforgiven, which reflected on the cost of violence.
A hell of a thing, killing a man. You take away all he's got, and all he's ever gonna have.
I spoke with Clint Eastwood and with Time magazine film critic Richard Schickel, who has written a new biography of Eastwood. Eastwood got his big break with Rawhide. I told Eastwood that judging from the biography, I probably liked Rawhide a lot more than he did. He played Rowdy Yates, the young assistant trail boss. Eastwood used to call the character Rowdy Yates' trail flunky and Rowdy Yates' idiot of the plains.
Actually, I liked the role. It was we just used to sit around the set and use self-demeaning kind of humor as a way of keeping our sanity out there doing a series week in, week out. And I think that Eric Fleming used to call himself Mr. Failure instead of Mr. Favier, and I used to call myself Rodney Yates Trail Flunky. And we'd just kind of, just joke about it. It was nothing that nobody disliked the series particularly. We just had, it was just kind of a way, and somebody picked up on it, I guess, is that it was a total unhappiness. It wasn't unhappiness, it was just kind of a way that to keep yourself amused, I suppose. Eventually, when you do a series, after the years go by, you do start to get frustrated. You like to go on and do something else.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose I'm no exception in that case.
I think, too, that Rowdy was, boyish beyond his years toward the end of the series. I think maybe that Clint wanted to be, a somewhat more dangerous figure, thus a more interesting figure to act. I mean, I'm kind of guessing there based on some of our conversations, but I think, any actor trapped in a role that seems to be relatively unchanging is eventually going to say, how come I don't get to, you know, romp and stomp a little bit?
Well, Clint Eastwood, you started your career as a contract player at Universal Studios in the kind of last gasp of the studio system. Were you being groomed for a particular type of role? Did they see you as a type?
No, they didn't see me hardly at all. they put people under contract in those days, and then they promptly forget about them and hire back people that they'd had under contract in previous years. But I don't think I was being groomed for anything. They just were taking a shot, and there you are, and they put you in for 6 months or a year. You had an option every 6 months on these type of terms, and so they could drop you at any time. And they give you a quick evaluation after a year and say, well, maybe you're okay, maybe he's going to go somewhere, or maybe they put him in a bit part and the person shined. I played a lot of bit parts, but none of them particularly shined at that point.
Did you have any sense that your future was going to be in Westerns and in action films? Did you have a sense of that for yourself?
No, a lot of people thought, well, he's a tall guy, maybe he'd be good in Westerns. For some reason, somebody thinks that Western heroes are tall guys for some reason. That sort of based upon the predecessors of Gary Cooper, John Wayne, Randolph Scott, and what have you over the years. So they thought, well, maybe he'll play in Westerns or what have you. But nobody really knew. No, I was just kind of out there. And hanging about, studying acting, and it was a steady job. It was kind of nice at the time.
Many of the roles you've played have been, you know, men who are very strong, but men of few words. And it's ironic that your screen test for Rawhide was a long monologue that you were really uncomfortable with because you were having trouble at the time just remembering all of the words in this long monologue, and you didn't think of that as your strength as an actor. What do you think came through about you, even though you missed some of the words in the monologue?
Well, it was amusing because they told me it was going to be an interview test, and I'd done interview tests before.
This is where you just talk with the director?
Exactly. You just talk with the director, and I disliked those intensely because sometimes they ask you, what's your name? Why did you do this? Why? It's a quick interview, usually by somebody who doesn't know how to do interviews. And you sit there on film and look sort of drop-jawed. But this was a test where they said, here, would you like, how are you at learning lines? I said, pretty good. And the guy said, here, well, here's a whole page of dialogue. Said, could you be ready to do this in a half hour? And so I thought, well, I just take the different beats and play those, and the different changes in the scene, kind of play those up and see how it would go, and just use my own words. The director happened to be the writer in that case, and he liked every word that he had written, so he was a little bit taken back. But it worked out all right in the end, because the people who viewed it and made the final decision didn't know the dialogue and could care less. They just wanted to see a look and a certain expression.
Why do you think you've gravitated to parts that are parts of few words? Is it that you don't like to remember or learn lines, or is it a sensibility thing that you gravitate more
toward? No, it's just
that?
A sensibility thing. Mm-hmm. I think in the case of Fistful of Dollars, a first feature film I played in...
With
Sergio Leone, that I thought that the character would be much more interesting the less he spoke, the less you knew about him. I thought it would be... He'd be a more interesting character, and that often happens when you're doing a character in a play. That the person who talks the most, after a while, you know, you get tired of hearing the conversation. You want to know what's inside. Sometimes a silent moment, you can set up more of an effect than you can by just rambling on reams of dialogue. But later on, it's changed. My last picture, they couldn't shut me up.
one of the things I noticed that Clint said, and it's in the book, is I think he likes himself as a viewer of movies. He prefers to kind of lean in to hear, you know. I mean, in other words, I think he has a feeling that a little bit of mystery about a character doesn't fully explain himself at every minute. is a character that draws us toward the screen, whereas if a guy is explaining himself constantly, you know, you sort of say, well, you know, why couldn't I be allowed to figure this out for myself? And you kind of, you know, it can kind of push you back from the screen instead of drawing you in.
Yeah, and Rawhide, too, those years, a lot of times the screenwriting that would come in on those scripts would be very expository. In other words, they felt that they had to explain a lot of things in one scene so they wouldn't have to film other scenes. And you get so tired of reeling out exposition that mm-hmm. You felt that this was an opportunity to just use a little bit of economy and see if you could tell a story that way.
Well, in some of your action roles, in some of your westerns and like Dirty Harry films, you not only don't say a lot, but what you do say, you're saying often through clenched teeth, you know, in that really guttural voice. How did you develop that style of speaking?
I don't know what you're talking about. Well, I think that the character just drives you in that. It's a character who is maybe frustrated with the things that the common person on the street are frustrated with, the bureaucracy that we live in, the nightmare that we as a civilization have placed on ourselves. I think this is a person who is frustrated with that, especially if you're trying to solve a case in a limited amount of time. So, and I don't know, it's just the thought of the time.
One of the things that Clint said to me that I thought was interesting and amusing is that, you know, he did five Dirty Harry films. He said, well, the thing about Dirty Harry is he always got the best lines in the movies. He maybe didn't have the most lines, but, you know, Harry Callahan generally got the topper. You know, the funny, smart, well-turned phrase, some of which have become catchphrases.
Okay, now the onus is on one of you to recite a couple of those phrases.
I am not doing my Clint Eastwood imitation. Oh, go ahead, Clint, make her day.
Yeah, the make my day line or the do you feel lucky, punk, kind of lines were lines that people gravitated towards.
Did you have a sense of that reading the script that, you know, presidents would be, you know, making, you know, improvising on those lines and that they would just enter the general vocabulary? Could you read a script and say, these lines are going to last beyond the film?
Nobody can say that for sure. But you can kind of... You can kind of find the lines that are sort of squelch lines, the ones that come in and put a topper on it. I think the appeal of some of those early characters was the fact that the man would have the right answer, and it was always usually very terse and kind of right to the point, but with a little bit of humor involved. So that everybody said, God, I would love to be able to do that.
Have you ever been able to do that, have just the right comeback at just the right moment?
Very rarely.
Right. Now, when you're doing a line like "Make My Day," and you know, okay, this is a really good line, do you like go home and do line readings and go "Make my day, make my day, make my day," and just do it over and over until you figure out exactly how you want to do it?
Looking into the bathroom right. mirror and doing some of your best acting.
Are you talking to me?
No, I don't. I don't go over the lines. I don't play them out loud. I'd rather play them for the first time when I do them.
No,
and
really?
I usually do them by the motivation of what the feelings are at the time. So I start them from what the intent is and then let it kind of go out. It's sort of like a blowing through a trumpet or something. You start and the sound magnifies as it comes out. If you sit there and practice line readings to yourself, you'll just get confused.
My guests are Clint Eastwood and Richard Schickel, who's written a new biography of Eastwood. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are Richard Schickel and Clint Eastwood. Richard Schickel has written a new biography of Clint Eastwood. I want to get to your spaghetti westerns, the films you made with Sergio Leone. You started the Sergio Leone films when you were still making Rawhide, the TV western. How did Sergio Leone get to see Rawhide and decide you were the one to star in his Western?
He had seen an episode that somebody had was showing around, an agency had in Rome. And he had seen an episode, and they thought, well, here's a chance to hire an American actor who has been doing Westerns, but is not very expensive. And that, they didn't have any.
Right.
They didn't have any money to spend, so they didn't have a lot of choices as far as names of the moment.
What was it like for you to make the transition from upstanding assistant trail boss to mystery Western tough guy?
Well, it was great fun because all of a sudden I was playing something completely different than I had been playing, and I got to experiment a lot. I could do we'd do everything with a look. Leone was very visual, and unlike television, where sometimes they just want to shoot talking heads, he was shooting in a very kind of an expansive way, and it was fun. It was also fun to work with a European crew and watch other people who see their approaches to it and how it all unravels from their point of view over there.
There's a lot of really interesting facial close-ups in your movies with Sergio Leone, and he had a very iconographic way of shooting faces, particularly your face. And your face in those close-ups is often, mysterious, unknowable. Instead of the facial close-ups like revealing this essence of who you are, they reveal the unknowability of who you are. And I've always wondered, what were you thinking during those close-ups to get the right expression on your face?
The first response would be to say absolutely nothing to get the... George Cukor used to say he'd tell Greta Garbo sometimes to look into the camera and stare and don't think about a thing. But that's maybe a little oversimplification or a way to get a certain effect out of her at that time. But you think about what you're doing with the plot line, what the demands are of the plot. Usually, because this character, though he wasn't saying a lot, he was plotting a lot. And so you just thought about what your next moves were. It's just a question of thinking like you would in real life. You don't, and you may be thinking, you have an inner monologue. Every actor plays an inner monologue as you're playing your outer character. And sometimes your outer character is saying, good evening, it's wonderful to see you. But underneath you might be saying, yeah, dirty, rotten. So you know, you really don't... care, and so that's your inner monologue. And so I might have been saying something like that to myself at the time. Is you know,
you
I don't like these guys. I'd like to, you know, blow them all away. But I'd be very pleasant at the moment.
You developed a squint also in some of those close-ups.
Well, that was just the sunlight. And
was it?
Yeah. They bomb me with a bunch of lights, and you're outside, and it's 90 degrees. It's hard not to squint.
Richard Schickel, yeah. I want to ask you what you think of the importance of the Sergio Leone films in Clint Eastwood's filmmaking career.
Oh, I sort of think that Clint would have made his way into wider public consciousness in some other fashion, but I do also feel that those movies were so singular. They were truly, deeply, profoundly revisionist Westerns, as Clint has often said, at a time when the Western was in a kind of a dull place. The traditions of the Western in America had been kind of used up, and though we were in a period where Westerns were very popular in television and coming out of a period in which they had been very popular in the theaters, nonetheless... You know, the basic Western moves, the traditional moves, had become dull and overused and kind of cliche-ridden. And I think it's one of the things that drew Clint to this was that opportunity, not just for his own character to expand a bit, but for him to participate in a kind of a revision of a form that he actually liked. I mean, it's important to remember that, you know, Clint does know quite a bit about film history and so forth. He had seen Yojimbo, the Kurosawa movie, which was a source for this particular movie for Fistful of Dollars. And he'd seen it 2 years before and had said, hey, this would make a great Western, but I don't think anybody in America will make it because it's too tough. And here were these crazy Italians who were, you know, willing to do exactly that.
Clint Eastwood, since there's been these great iconographic close-ups of your face, I'm wondering what you think of your face as a man, an actor, and as a director, because you've had to work with your face as a director and look at it very objectively, I'd imagine.
As a director, you think of yourself as another character. Well, a lot of times when I'm talking to the editor, I'll say, when he comes in the room and she does this and hey, that goes here and what have you, I never think of myself in the first person. It's just you have to do that, and you know you don't dwell on your face. You dwell on the fact that you're there and the character. And if you think too much about certain things, you can get yourself very confused. So, rather than do that, you just forge right on ahead with what you're doing.
Clint Eastwood and Richard Schickel, who's written a new biography of Eastwood. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Richard Schickel and Clint Eastwood will be back in the second half of our show. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Clint Eastwood and Time Magazine film critic Richard Schickel, who has written a new biography of Eastwood. When we left off, we were talking about Eastwood's iconic role in the spaghetti westerns directed by Sergio Leone. Now, in Richard Schickel's book about you, he says that, Rawhide followed the strict production code of the time. You couldn't show a fired gun and the victim of the bullet in the same shot. There had to be an edit in between. What was your reaction to Sergio Leone's really vivid approach to violence?
Well, that was true. The Hayes office at that time had a rule for Westerns only, ironically, and you couldn't show the shootee and the shooter in the same shot. It couldn't be a tie-up shot, in other words. So you'd have to do it as an individual cut. And if you look at even later American Westerns of High Noon, you won't see the tie-up. But Sergio didn't know about all that, and I wasn't about to tell him because I was really enjoying this. It was breaking all, we were trying to break all the molds. And in breaking all the molds, it made those pictures a hit, or as somewhat of a revisionist idea, or certainly an outsider's point of view. They became popular, but they also brought with it some resentment, as you and Richard touched on earlier in the show. There was a lot of people who felt that who was this upstart? We didn't come in and bless this guy to come along, and we didn't bless these movies to come along, an Italian interpretation of the great American genre. So there was a certain resentment that hung around with those pictures for some time. Now, as people look back on them, they enjoy the fact that there was a different this was a different period, and then it went on to somebody else. And Sam Peckinpah came along later, and he did another look at the Western. And someone else comes along and does another one. And I come back to him and take another shot. And somebody else down the line. That way, it keeps the great American art form alive.
Well, I think one thing that's interesting when you do look back at the Leone films is today, despite all of the hubbub about their violence, they're not terribly violent movies by modern standards, by the standards of the 90s.
There's a lot of really sick, sadistic people in them.
That's true, and yet. Leone, for the most part, does not linger on the actual violence. He lingers on the lead-up to violence.
I mean, the savoring of the violence.
There's a kind of a dance, and almost, sort of stately minuet leading up to the violence. I mean, the concluding shootouts and these things, it's a long and elegant time as people circle one another and in effect threaten one another. But the actual death is very quick. It's very clean. You know, we don't see a lot of blood squibs going off in the Peckinpah manner or slow motion death. Death is in these movies, as it so often is in life. I mean, it's quick, nasty, brutal, but it's not something that is in and of itself aestheticized. What's around it is aestheticized, but that the actual moment is not. It's shown for the brutal thing that it is.
The first Dirty Harry film was directed by Don Siegel, who you did several films with, including Coogan's Bluff, Two Mules for Sister Sarah, The Beguiled. What are some of the things you feel you learned about acting and directing from your association with him?
Well, directorially, he was a terribly efficient man who had come up through the ranks. Started out with a montage department at Warner Brothers many years before. He'd done quite a few second vision films, or B-movies, he used to call. Some of them quite good, some of them classics, like Invasion of the Body Snatcher. And he was terribly efficient, because he had to be. He never had the luxury of the big budgets and that some other directors might have had, and he was terribly underrated, because he could make a lot happen with very little. And so you learned how a person could go to work every day and be efficiently turn out a certain amount of work. I had worked with other directors like that. I'd worked with directors like that in television. Mm-hmm, some of them mm-hmm. really quite good, but Don had never really captured the mainstream of the of Hollywood. I guess maybe because he was sort of a cantankerous guy and he sort of marched to his own drummer. But he, what you learn from somebody like that is, you don't have to sit and dwell and
be the great artiste.
You can be an artist, but not an artiste.
Right,
yeah, exactly.
The first Dirty Harry film was very controversial. A lot of people saw it as a cop who was a real law and order, right-wing kind of cop. Don't worry about reading somebody their rights. Don't worry about obeying the law. Just make the collar and, you know, get them behind bars. Paul Newman apparently turned down the role for political reasons. What did you see, Clint Eastwood? What did you see in this role when you took it on? What interested you in the character?
I saw an exciting detective story. I saw a script that was concerned about the victims of violent crime rather than the accused, so that was an interesting way to go. There was no big call to drop all rights of the accused of crime or anything like that. It just happened to be a frustrating situation, all set up by the Harry Julian Fink script of the fact that there was a time element in having to solve the case. There's nothing right-wing about that. There's nothing... they weren't intended to be that way. Don Siegel and myself just saw it as a chance to do an exciting film. If somebody wanted to politicize it, that's fine. There's a couple comments about Miranda and a few decisions like that, but I think there's been in recent years some discussion about that, maybe some of those decisions are not always practical. That's the way it is. I think the blue-collar person out there, the Mr. and Mrs. Middle America, who sit there and we're watching the press being constantly concerned with the accused and never once thinking about victims, saw this movie as somewhat of a breath of fresh air. Since that movie and that time, we're in another era now where they have victims' rights organizations and all kinds of attention put upon that. But at that particular time, nobody had the imagination to picture themselves the victim of violent crime.
Did you feel misunderstood?
It was misunderstood. It wasn't misunderstood. I think the public didn't misunderstand it at all. I think it was misunderstood by some people who felt that you had to put a political connotation to absolutely every film that's made, and sometimes there are times when you have to rely on the old Alfred Hitchcock adage that it's only a movie.
Clint Eastwood, I thought that your choice of directing and starring in The Unforgiven was such an interesting choice, because it's a movie about a man who goes from bad man to good man to myth. And it's also interesting because it's about the difficulty of killing someone and what it takes out of you when you do kill someone. And you'd been in so many mythic movies and been in so many movies where the character that you played killed a lot of people. So I'm interested in how you related to the story in The Unforgiven and how it dealt with myth-making and with violence.
Well, those exact things that you mentioned are what attracted me to the project. The fact that, but even though I had done pictures where I've been a police officer and Western films where I've had a lot of gunplay and stuff, it's not that I approved of that sort of thing. And I don't necessarily approve of the romanticizing of gunplay, and I don't think it's... And I thought here was a chance, here was a story that had that sort of shot holes in that, if you'll pardon the pun. You know, it brought out the truth about gunplay and the fact that there is some loss to your soul when you commit an act of violence. And to play a person who was deeply affected in his life because of some of the mayhem that he'd been responsible for was to me made the character more interesting. It was more interesting for me to play, and the that particular in fact, I never thought the film would be really commercial when I was making it, because it had all these statements about mayhem and violence, and I thought maybe this might not be a straight ahead action movie that people wanted, but I liked the story and I felt it was worth telling.
My guests are Clint Eastwood and Richard Schickel, who's written a new biography of Eastwood. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Clint Eastwood and Richard Schickel, who's written a new biography of Eastwood. Well, Clint Eastwood, I feel like I must talk with you a little bit about music. And to kick off this chapter of our interview, let's listen to this.
Give me land, lots of land, under starry skies above. Don't fence me in. Let me ride through the wide open country that I love. Don't fence me in. Let me be by myself in the evening breeze. Listen to the murmur of the cottonwood trees. Send me off forever, but I ask you please. Don't fence me in.
Just turn me loose. Let me saddle my old saddle underneath the west.
Terry, you should have seen the pain in this room, right?
And that's from the album Clint Eastwood Sings Cowboy Favorites. And there's a picture of Clint Eastwood as Rowdy Yates on the cover. Rawhide's Clint Eastwood Sings
that was,
Cowboy Favorites.
Yeah. I was the Millie Vanilli of the moment there. I did, that wasn't me.
Oh, yes, it was. I actually like your singing voice. I really do. I mean, this is a strange album with strange arrangements and not always good songs, but I really like your singing, and I imagine you're also like influenced by Chet Baker in your singing. And...
Well, that wasn't first place. That wasn't the kind of songs that I would normally like to sing.
The songs on here, I'd imagine not. But you got to sing Cole Porter. Don't fence me in.
There's nothing wrong with that. Cole Porter is certainly wonderful. But what happened is that somebody had the brilliant idea that that I should do some cowboy songs, not country western songs. Nashville type, but real straight cowboy songs, and I wasn't sure whether I liked the idea, but they said, "Well, we'll do it, and we have a session tomorrow." And I said, "Well, tomorrow I'm leaving." "Well, will you do it? You just stop by the studio on the way to the airport." So I did a whole album. You think about people who take 6 months to make an album, but this one, that we did the whole album in one session, and I didn't know the songs. I had to come in and learn them real quick. And some of them I knew, some songs like that you've heard as a child, but you don't really know them. And so it was a little frustrating. It wasn't my favorite musical experience in life, but it was, there again, you learn something every day.
Now, had you sung much before? Did you think of yourself as a singer at all?
Not really. I'd done a few things. I'd done a few records. I'd been involved in music, so I could sometimes carry a tune. My father loved singing. He had a group that played, and he loved to sing all the time. He would love to have been a singer more than anything, I think.
Now, I know you're still, and were as a young man, very passionate about jazz. Did you ever think that you'd become a professional musician instead of an actor and director?
Well, I thought about that earlier when I was a kid and I was doing some things, but I never thought, I never really knew what I wanted to do until I became an actor. And then at that point, I kind of knew which direction I was going to at least get up and swing at the bat.
Would you like to sing more or play more? Or?
No, I don't have any there's a one of my key sayings.
Yes.
A man must know his limitations.
Clint Eastwood and film critic Richard Schickel. Schickel has written a new biography of Eastwood.
When things look bad, it looks like you're not going to make it, then you got to get mean. I mean plumb mad dog mean. Because if you lose your head and you give up, then you neither live nor win. That's just the way it is.